Hello, my name is Robert Levine, and this is The Disposable Web. The Disposable Web is the sequel to the Social Business Hangout podcast series available on iTunes. My guest is...
I'm Mark Bell. I'm owner and publisher of Film Threat.
And what is Film Threat?
Film Threat is, it is a website now. It was a magazine that started in 1985 as a zine, as a college zine by Chris Gore, who many people might know from when he was on Attack of the Show. He also has been on TV, a film pundit. But for years, you know, he was a college student, and he did this film zine called Film Threat, which was something he made because he wanted to see more about the movies he was interested in. You know, 85, you know, you were talking about mainstream stuff, and that was it. Like, you didn't really know that there was a world of underground filmmaking out there, but there was. And Film Threat was kind of one of the first groups to really kind of turn their eyes in that direction. In the early 90s, Film Threat, the zine, sold to Larry Flint Publications, where it became the Film Threat that it most made its name as, which was the voice for independent film. Truth and Entertainment was the motto at the time. And that was... that was really the beginning of, like, the Richard Linklaters, the Steven Soderberghs, Kevin Smith, Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino, and Film Threat was really the only ones looking in that direction. So when those guys were coming up, that's Film Threat was the one doing all the writing about them. And then when they hit it huge, you know, Film Threat was a big part of that world. Film Threat stayed a magazine up until really the late 90s, and at that point, obviously, the internet had kind of cemented itself. And that's when Film Threat made the jump over to internet only, which I believe was in 97. And we keep to the same ideas of looking at the independent film and underground stuff. And we're very playful in our senses of humor. We're critics, but we're not snarky for the sake of snark. I actually get no pleasure out of saying anything bad about a movie because, you know, I want to, like, it's a waste of my time to see a really crummy movie. So I only want to see good movies. And, you know, when you see a crummy movie and then you write crummy things about it, you're taking a waste of your time and then compounding it, you know? So, like, I don't even want to say horrible things about a movie I find horrible. I just want to forget that it happened. But, you know, it's part of the gig as a critic is you write your feelings, your honest feelings. So it's, and your honest opinions. So it's one of those things that, yeah, Film Threat, we focus the indie and the underground. We go to a lot of film festivals. See a lot of content. We hit the big ones, the Sundance, the Slamdance, and the South by Southwest, Toronto. But that's the world. We look at the films that a lot of people don't know exist. But we don't even cover everything. So it's that's the world. It's very niche, independent, underground world. But that's where we live.
Now, Mark, you and I have known each other on and off, and when I say on and off, I mean on and off the ball hockey rink, but on and right. off for, you know, about 4 years, give or take. And believe it or not, I actually probably saw you before you saw me, because when I moved to Brantford, it was because of a hockey trip back in 2010 to see a certain fat man play in goal. And that fat man, of course, was Kevin Smith. But there was another fat man right there in goal, and that was you. But we didn't know each other then. It took us probably a year, if not a year and a half, from that encounter to actually get to know each other. Before we get into Film Threat, let's talk on that. Your thoughts on ball hockey and as it relates, because I do have a jersey that has Film Threat written all over it.
Right. I mean, I think I actually think the first time we met, what might have been in New Jersey, because I think you came out for a ball hockey weekend in Jersey. Am I right?
That is correct, indeed.
And that was before you joined. I was captain of the Monroeville Zombies at the time, and you joined my team after that. And so, yeah, like we definitely would have seen each other in Brantford, but yeah, we didn't really start talking to each other until after Jersey. But yeah, I mean, ball hockey's been. What, since 2009 is when I started going up to Brantford and playing, and it's been an annual, you know, blast, a lot of fun, a lot of great people I know over the course of that time, and it's just an awesome time. And I mean, I didn't start in goal. I eventually ended up in goal just because we had 2 years in a row. It was like Spinal Tap where we kept losing goalies. So finally I just made the commitment to be a goalie because I'm, cause as you said, the other fat man. So it's like, I'm not the fastest guy running up and down the court. So I figured if I was in goal, it would be a little bit easier. But then I found out you have to get up and down a lot. Yeah. And that's not as easy. So,
well, you know, and, you know, not to get into specific topics, but to your point, you know, you're playing in another hockey team now, and right. That there's actually quite a few potential goalies in that team. So you might actually find yourself outside of the net again.
Yeah. And I think, and I have absolutely no problem with that. Because mainly, I mean, I bought a regular hockey stick like a year ago, and I haven't really touched it. So it's one of those things where it's like, I kind of want to use it. So I have no problem not playing goal, and it would be fun. And yeah, we do have like two or three goalies on my team already as it is. And I have no problem sharing the net. But the other thing about goal tending, and particularly our group, is we're not like all seasoned athletes that work at goal, hockey year round. Like, it's all very much recreational for all of us. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us, like, we might play one game and goal and be like, I'm done. Mm. You know, it's like, I don't want to play goal for the next game. And so it's nice to have more than one goalie. So I might wind up playing goal anyway, or I might not. So we'll see. But it's nice to actually maybe have a rotation for once.
Well, and the reason I bring all this up, and you kind of said it yourself, the reason that you were playing in that game back in Brantford and continued to do so was because Kevin Smith decided that it'd be a good way to bring together people that, like him, were not necessarily the most athletic, and right. Do something that everybody enjoys at a pace that they enjoy and kind of get together there. And I think because of the nature of Kevin Smith, it brought a lot of people together that enjoy movies and pop culture and stuff like that. So there was an interesting mix of individuals. And I think all of that plays into a lot of those people probably would be similar people that you run into when you do your stuff for Film Threat.
Yeah, I mean, it's filmmakers. Obviously, filmmakers come from, you know, almost anyone can be a filmmaker nowadays. And so you get a wide range of people that do it. It's like anything, when you kind of get more into the geeky realm of things, you kind of get away from the more athletic. But I feel like those kind of stereotypical lines that have been drawn for years don't necessarily apply either, because, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan. I'm barely athletic, but I'm also a pretty big geek. And, you know, I love movies and I love music and all those other things. So I think it kind of gets muddled. So in some ways, you know, a little less athletic, but in other ways, I mean, particularly like just taking our group as an example, there are people in our group who are ridiculously athletic and good at ball hockey, and they are good at soccer, or they are good at golf. You know what I mean? Like, they're mm-hmm. good at a lot of stuff. They chose to play with our group when they probably could be playing in a much more competitive realm if they wanted to. And so it really comes down to temperament more than, say, like athletic talent. But I feel like pretty much even in the filmmaking world, it's just like everything is so anyone and everyone nowadays. So it's not like it used to feel. And I don't think it's not always been this way. I feel like it used to feel like there was, particularly with filmmaking, there was like this ordained set of people that did it. But just like punk kind of changed that idea for music, I feel like the independent film movement probably in the late 80s, early 90s changed that feel for filmmaking, because then that's when everything started going like, okay, this person can do it. And if this person can do it, let's, you know, keep in the theme with Kevin Smith. Mm-hmm. All right, if Kevin Smith can go max out his credit cards and make a movie, I can max out my credit cards and make a movie. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Which, well, the lesson shouldn't be max out your credit cards. But.
Well, I think this is one of the reasons why I also wanted to have you on the Disposable Web, because a lot of what we talk about in this series is about, you know, how technology has really changed how we approach things. And to your point right. about the movie making industry, just like the photography industry, you know, the old joke is if you've got a camera, you can call yourself a photographer. If right. you have yourself an 8mm and the ability to, you know, release it to the masses, you're now a filmmaker. But, yep. you know, we didn't have the releases to the masses until very recently. We've had a lot of people that had access to inexpensive gear. So you had a lot of home movies and a lot of indie stuff, but not to the scale where, you know, now we're looking at crowdfunding and, you know, stuff that could be released on Vimeo as an example. Right. And boom, you've got a worldwide release of a movie, and now all that money's going towards marketing.
Yeah, no, I mean it's very much a different world. I mean, even when I was in college and was working on my first film, you know, the thing you did was you shot on film. Like, you shot 16mm for an independent film. That's just what you did. Mm-hmm. And you know, not like a year, 2 years removed from college, my college got a film class, film study group, and, you know, digital video came in. And that was kind of like the democratization of filmmaking, because all of a sudden, you know, digital video meant you could kind of edit your stuff at home, and all these tools got a lot easier to work in that regard. And then the internet, as you're pointing out, kind of, you know, YouTube got started, and then Vimeo got started, and everything just kind of started flowing into those, and it became like, all right, I can get my stuff out there. The traditional dream for filmmaking release was get picked up by a distributor. Distributor puts my movie in the theaters, and then it gets released on video, you know, VHS, DVD, mm-hmm. whatever. I'd say that that's changed now in the sense that, particularly for indie film, like a lot of independent films are not even going to get near theatrical. The closest thing to theatrical they're ever going to get is playing in a theater as attached to a film festival.
Yeah.
But a film festival isn't also the gimme or the given that it used to be. Like, you don't need to do film festivals nowadays. You can go direct to the masses. If you have an audience, you can, you know, just do a Vimeo release, or you can even do a torrent release.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of distributors nowadays are VOD first. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you might still get picked up by a distributor, but you'll go VOD and you'll wind up on someone's, you know, cable listing, because that's the entire idea, is like they're constantly needing content. We're starting to get into that area now where the need for the content and the amount of content, like, they've been kind of getting closer to equal, and eventually they're going to stray off again.
Mm-hmm.
And the need for it's going to drop, and the supply is going to explode again. And, you know, it's going to be, all of a sudden there's going to be a need for a new way to get films out there, because a lot of stuff's going to start getting overlooked again. And we're kind of in that kind of equilibrium stage right now.
Well, I think to your point, and this is where I kind of equate it to, if all you had was one big billboard and everybody looked at that billboard every day and you said that this is what the movie of the day is, you know, you would be aware of that. And to your point, so much right. content's out there, but we're also so distributed as well. It's almost shifting back to that point where there's going to be that much more, because the production costs are going to be considerably less because of all the stuff we've talked about. The distribution right. costs will be less, but the cost to market it to the masses to be able to generate the level of profits that people are talking about nowadays, that becomes a sales and marketing piece, not necessarily a distribution or production piece.
Right. And I mean, a lot of filmmakers take it upon themselves to do their own marketing. And I feel like it was the same thing when people were doing distribution themselves. It's kind of like, you can do that and you can probably do a pretty good job at it, but is that what you want to do? Because when you start wearing all the hats, you kind of stop being filmmaker
mm-hmm.
and you start being marketer and you start being distributor. You start being crowdfunding, you know, a fundraiser person. And so, like, it kind of gets to the point where a lot of these jobs kind of should be specialized. But I feel like people are kind of learning that as they go through that experience. They're like, I don't really want to be a distributor. I want to make more movies, you know. But I definitely think that nowadays, particularly with you know, obviously with social media and kind of like it's about building that grassroots audience. And, you know, because this is the thing, the audience, if you make a movie, as my friend Dan Mervish, who started the Slamdance Film Festival, mm-hmm. is fond of saying, you know, if you make a movie and nobody watches it, did you make a movie? And it's kind of like, that's the thing with, you know, where social media is concerned. Like, a lot of people still want to do that traditional thing where a distributor comes in and saves the day. But it's like, that's not necessarily going to get you an audience. Like, the audience building is something that happens year round. And it's something that you do with social media. It's something you do with your film. Like, you can't expect someone to come save you and do all the work for you. Like, those are kind of once in a lifetime stories. Like, going back to the Kevin Smith thing, you know, Kevin Smith has often been put up as the poster boy for the get your film into Sundance, get a distribution deal, and your life is set. But the reality is, that's not really the way it worked. And it only really worked that way, close to that way, once, and it was for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where it's an interesting dream to kind of chase after, but the fact of the matter is, the reality is, you know, a lot of films, just keep them with Sundance, get into Sundance and don't get distribution, don't go anywhere. So it's just one of those things where it's like the reality of the situation is you're constantly working at it. The marketing's year round, distribution is year round. But that's the world for the independent filmmaker, at least. The mainstream stuff is obviously way different.
Well, and to your point, independent quite often indicates a small group of people or a single owner or whatnot. And as you say, if the money is there and the product is there, then you can scale it to specialized individuals and so forth.
Right.
And now you're no longer an independent, you're more in a partnership type of thing. You brought up a very good point, though, using Kevin as the example there. The 1% or whatever that percent may be, regardless of the music industry, the movie industry, the print industry, you know, you always hear the success stories, but you know, for every filmmaker that maxed out their credit card and used their office as a location, there's probably more stories of people that didn't get that distribution, or the guy swinging in to save the day at the last minute and, you know, were out all of that money. So to your point, we kind of glamorize the successes, and those successes to a certain degree continue. But let's be honest, there's far more stories of failure out there, and you probably see a lot of those, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah. And I mean, and of course, failure is relative too, because it's like, you know, I always look at, like, again, back to the, if you make a film, you want people to see your film. So if people are seeing your film, did you really fail? The next tier to that would be, you know, how much money did your film make? And, you know, did your investors get anything back? And then that's another level of whether or not you want to gauge success that way. But I feel like that kind of goes from filmmaker to filmmaker. But I feel like on the very basic level, it's like, did you make the movie you want to make, you know, for you? Mm-hmm. And then the next step is, did people get to see your movie? And I feel like if you can hit one of those two, you're in good shape. And then the rest of it, you know, is, I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to be outside of your control anyway, but I feel like those are the two really, really big things, at least for filmmaking. And that can be seen, I guess, maybe a little optimistic and naive of me.
No, I'm kind of seeing a scale when you're describing that, because if I'm reading between the lines there, the next level after that would be either a sequel or a multi-film gig, or you know, the marketing of products and stuff like that, right? So to your point, what is success? Is it
right?
The people saw, did I do the movie that I wanted to do? First
right.
level. Did people see the movie that I wanted to do? Yes. You know, it make money for me and my investors for the movie that I wanted to do that people got
right.
to see? Yes. You know, and after that comes, you know, what's success after that? Is it George Lucas never making a good movie ever again, but making a shit ton of money on toys?
Right.
Or is it Steven Spielberg not making money on toys, but making a lot of great movies? Like, what is success at that point?
Right. And it's obviously it's going to vary for the individual.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like in the most basic thing, like, again, we might as well just say this will be very Kevin Smith centric, because he's very easy in the sense of the independent film world to point to, because he's had a long career so far, obviously, and he's done a lot of different things, and he's done a lot of different things in a different way. And I think it's easy to point out when you have a strange example to be like, well, the one that Kevin did that.
Mm.
And so it makes sense. So like, we look at Tusk, right?
Mm-hmm. I just watched that a few days ago, actually.
Yeah. Now Tusk is a movie that was not going to get made any other way.
No. Well, for people that don't know it, it started as a off-the-cuff conversation between Kevin and Scott on a podcast.
Yep, Scott Mosier's,
you know,
producer.
I think 200 episodes into their podcast series or whatnot. And all of a sudden, he started a Twitter campaign that said, Tusk yes, Tusk no. And if enough people did Tusk yes, which is basically a way of crowdsourcing interest,
yep,
he then went ahead and did it. Now, how he managed to do it, maybe you take over from that point forward.
Well, it's obviously, he has a few more resources than someone just starting out. So he definitely had, you know, people he could get on the phone and producers he could talk to as far as the more kind of technical aspects of getting the film made. But it was a sort of thing, like, again, on the very basic level, even though he got interest from the audience, the entire idea behind Tusk of a film about a guy who basically answers a personal ad about a guy who's obsessed with walruses. And I don't want to say more, because I don't want to, you know, give anything away about the film, because I feel like the way the film works the best is when you're surprised by it.
Yes.
It's one of those things where, like, if you went to a studio and you pitched this idea, or you went to many people and pitched this idea, you know, they would kind of be like, I don't know. But he wanted to make the film because he wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean on that, like, very basic level.
Well, it's to your, like, point, that he wanted to do a movie that he thought of. A certain
right.
degree of people showed interest in doing, and did those people get to see it?
Yes, exactly. and across the board, all three. But it's a sort of thing where, like, had he put, like, had the basic levels not been of an interest to him, like, had he had no interest in making that movie,
mm-hmm.
like, it doesn't get further.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like the reason it works is because in a lot of ways, when you're watching this movie, the guy who's most entertained by it is the guy who made it. And I feel like that kind of, when I worked at a video store, we had the owner, I was a manager at the time. The owner told me that, cause my tastes were very odd as far as movies. I was definitely more independent underground and, mm-hmm. and, you know, the blockbusters of the world didn't necessarily go that route. And also, at the time, VHS tapes were like, if you wanted a movie, you had to pay $100
yes.
to get a VHS for rental. And if rentals are $3, like, you could have that movie and never recoup the cost of, you know, getting the movie for your store. So well, my
especially
taste,
in many cases, you were finding yourself not just buying one, you'd be buying 10.
Right. But for the really obscure stuff, which is kind of what I gravitated towards, it was... you know, it was always kind of a battle, a budget battle for me as the manager. Like, mm-hmm. You know, this is a movie I really want to watch and I really want to have. However, do I honestly think it'll make back its money? And, you know, practical me would be like, I don't think it's ever going to make back its money. And one day, another video store in the area had one of the obscure movies that I wanted. And I went to that other video store and rented it and watched it and loved it and came back. And my owner, you know, of the store was like, because it was New Hampshire, so I guess small towns where it gets around, was like, I heard you went to blah, blah, blah store. And like it was a real kind of like betrayal conversation. And I was like, yeah. And she was like, well, why did you go to that store? And I told her, I'm like, well, they had this movie I was interested in seeing, and it's really obscure, and I didn't want to get it for the store because I didn't think it would make its money back. And the owner said something which I feel is really important and has kind of stuck with me to this day. And the owner said, if there's something out there that has caught your interest that much, your enthusiasm for it will bleed over to other people and they will be interested too.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you like it, someone else will like it. Like it, you're not going to be the only person on the face of the earth that likes this movie. Well, and if you like it that much, you're going to be able to, you know, express that to other people and they're going to be interested too. And to the Tusk idea, it's like Kevin liked it that much. You know, he was able to express that enthusiasm. It came across in the podcast. People said Walrus Yes just based on that enthusiasm alone. The idea is weird, but I mean, like, I think the enthusiasm is what really sells it. And then, you know, it goes to the next step. But at the basic, like, how many people would have thought of that idea? Like, I don't know. But it's just, it's the sort of thing where it's like, the enthusiasm starts with one and it extends over. So, like, don't do something because you think you're the only person who might dig it.
Well, I think, and just to continue on that Kevin aspect, and I'll backtrack to Red State, because that's where he did something that I thought was genius, and it kind of brought him back to the original roots, where he didn't necessarily have a distribution per se. He toured the film. So it was a right. scenario where he was already doing his live Q&A. So he says, tell you what, I'm going to do a live Q&A. I'm going to hit 10 major cities, and we're going to watch the movie together at the beginning and then talk about it or anything else you want to talk about. Boom. He took the two ideas of he became the distributor, the promoter, and the fact that he was in the room watching it with you. He brought that Slam Dance, Sundance, you know, Southwest vibe to every city he toured the thing with, right?
Yeah, he made it an event, which I think is something that if you can do as a filmmaker, it's important to do so. Because I mean, how many movies come out in theaters that, you know, you and I just don't go see?
Mm-hmm.
And these are just regular. But when you hear, I mean, I know some people were like, oh, but it's, you know, it's pricier, but it was an event. Like Kevin could go do that tour and just do a speaking gig and people would show up anyway. So, but if he can put that together with a movie that he wants to get out there, and based on the budget of his film was not huge,
mm-hmm.
it was quite recoupable with a tour. It was something, like, it was just a really, if you're going to self-distribute your film, that was a really, really smart way to go about it. And I think that, like, I was at the Sundance premiere when that was announced. And also, I mean, there was a lot of brouhaha there because he had said he was going to pick the distributor in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And technically he did.
Yeah, it was him.
It was him. And a lot of people were like, oh, I thought he was going to, it's kind of like, it's like a lot of people are like, I thought he was going to pick me. And so now I'm mad. It's like, no, I mean, come on, he's not an idiot.
But
so,
to your point, you have a scenario where because of, like, he did his own editing. He uses, you know, fairly inexpensive editing software on a Mac in many cases. Heck, some of the stuff, you know, he uses GarageBand, you know, for some of the stuff he does. So I wouldn't be surprised if he just, you know, used iMovie for some of the stuff as well. But my point being, they're not complicated edits. He does them all at home. The infrastructure that he needs to put this all together and then, as you say, tour it himself, if you've been able to build a community of 2,000 people or, you know, whatever that may be, and you're able to recoup $100 on each of those persons and you will tour it and it'll be factored in, you now have a budget. Yeah. And you have the equipment to be able to deliver on that cost in many cases.
But I think the message to get to the independent beginner filmmaker, mm-hmm. for instance, the important thing to underscore with all of this is, you know, when a lot of times we look at Kevin Smith, and I know that there was a lot of people when he was doing the distribution, people were like, I don't see how this can be a model for independent film distribution. Mm-hmm. We're not all Kevin Smith. But the thing was, the Kevin Smith in all capital letters that we know today was not Kevin Smith 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, his audience, he didn't start with that audience, you know? And so when, as an independent filmmaker, a beginning filmmaker, whatever, when you're looking at these successes of these guys who've come before you or women that have come before you, and you're like, oh, I can't attain that. It's like, well, you can't attain it if you don't do anything in the meantime. Like, you have to be building that audience now. Like, the audience existed for him to do that because he's been building it since the beginning. Like, he was the first guy to embrace his own message board and really talk to the fans, you know, on an almost daily basis. I mean, that's where my involvement with Kevin Smith, more so from a professional level, existed, because I used to frequent the message board from like 97 on till it stopped existing, you know, and it's one of those things where it's like he was building that audience from the very beginning. So you can't expect to hop in and have his audience, but you also can't expect to ever have his audience if you don't start. So, well,
and that was a conversation I actually had with Ming a while back, and maybe I get your thoughts on it as well. Mm-hmm. To me, and to your point, it's very difficult for us to not use Kevin Smith as our use case, because there's so many use cases that we can pick from. And it's someone that we both, you know, respect and know quite a bit about. But the point, right, I was getting at is he's always been so ahead of the curve in finding ways to engage with this community, whether or not that was the, right, message board, whether or not that was Twitter, whether or not that was Facebook, whether or not that was podcasting, yep, and even YouTube. You know, the video version of Spodcast was basically just streaming off of YouTube as well. So those are all the examples, but how does a person navigate all of that in this day and age when they're not a Kevin Smith already? So, I use this example somewhere, you know, in the other stuff I do. It's like, you know, the internet of 2008 is not the internet of 2014. So just because, right, it worked in 2008 does not guarantee you remotely the same thing. So in a 2014 world, what would that look like? What would that next evolution of community engagement be?
Well, and I think this is where kind of certain elements of the older stuff still work. And I feel like this is where film festivals still work. Mm. Because film festivals are, I always like to put it at a film festival, the film festival circuit, if you have a film and you go into it and you get picked by a festival, there's a good chance you're going to be on the festival circuit for a year to 2 years. Just because once your film starts showing, other festivals start inviting you, you start traveling around, and that's the film festival circuit. The beauty of the film festival circuit is it's like a music tour. You have people, an audience that wants to see movies. So they're already coming to the festival. So the part of you getting people into the theater is made easier, because you're not going to like just a random city and saying, hey, come see my movie, which is really challenging, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if it's part of a film festival, you're saying, hey, while you're at the festival, come to my screening. It's way easier. But I feel like that's where festivals still kind of work as far as community engagement. The other thing with festivals is you meet other filmmakers, you meet other industry professionals, you meet, you know, just, it's a very, very small world, and kind of you get caught up in that world, and it actually helps you along your way. So I think that just kind of throwing out into the internet and kind of trying to fight through the noise of it is very challenging. I feel like kind of the traditional route of film festivals is very helpful. One of the other things, is, you know, look for, obviously, this is where kind of Film Threat comes in, mm-hmm. is, you know, we've been covering independent and underground films since 85. So, you know, since before the internet was a big deal. Mm-hmm. So it's the sort of thing, like, we're looking for those types of movies. That's where our eyes are kind of gazed. And it's the frustrating thing kind of about the layout of the internet, and particularly film journalism or film blogging, or however you want to look at it, is that there are so many film sites out there, right?
Yeah.
But the percentage of them that actually look at the new guys, or even the sub new guys, like the ones that aren't even playing festivals yet, but are mm-hmm. making movies, you know, is minuscule. Like, it's such a niche. And it's like, these are the people, we don't need 200 film sites all sharing the same Star Wars teaser. We need like the three or four big ones that are going to do it, you know, that have beaten out the competition, you know, like say like Slash Film, mm-hmm. like let them share it. And everybody else, you know, give that attention to the new guys. And you wouldn't have that problem of community engagement, because all of these, you know, new filmmakers and the glut of filmmaking that exists, you know, would get eyes. They would get fans. They would get audience engagement. It would become a better system. You know, right now there's a few things that call themselves exclusive news, and everybody covers them. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, a huge grouping of stuff that no one covers. And it's like, you wouldn't have a bunch of websites doing the exact same thing if they just looked around once in a while. Just, they're all looking in the same direction. And kind of, and that, like I said, that's where Film Threat comes in, because we're not looking in that direction. Sometimes we do, but for the most part, you know, we're looking in the other direction, being like, where is everybody? Like, it's really cool over here. You know, you should come, like, hang out.
Well, and I think that's the beauty of sites, you know, because to your point, you being around since before the internet in that sense, you also lived through the days, just like everything else, where, you know, when there was only 41 websites, the 42nd website had a good chance of getting hits. How do you continue to build your niche? You know, you've been doing this for a very long time, so someone coming new into it doesn't have, obviously, that length of stay, you know, and all the SEO that goes with it or whatnot. So quite often what they'll do is they'll just do trend-based articles, because right. they'll see what's trending, talk about it, and scoop up the hits on the easy hits. Well, that's really no different than top 40 type of thing. You find out what the top 40 is, you read the list, you talk about the list, you move on. You know what yeah. I mean? So really, when we always talk about that depth or the lack of depth that we quite often get, you really need to get into a niche, because it's really only in the niche world where you really go deep. And I think right. that's where the real communities still are, where you've got that depth of topic and interest.
Yeah, and I mean, in the film, and even the film world, it's like, even when I use terms like independent, like, that means something completely different depending on who you are. Mm-hmm. Like, independent used to mean just outside the studio system. So that would mean, you know, stuff that played like Sundance. But then again, if you're a filmmaker who just made a movie in your backyard, you're looking at the movies that are playing Sundance, you know, starring Robert De Niro, and being like, how the hell? I'm not independent like that, you know? So then you're independent, but are they independent? Because they don't have distribution yet. Like, the De Niro film's not distributed yet, so that's kind of independent, but you can't get De Niro for your film. So then there's another level of independent. But then there's the person who's like, I'm doing animation of a bunch of static that I might splice in some footage of dogs crapping, and I'm going to call this experimental, and you're an even lower level of independent. Yeah. And I don't mean that like quality wise. I mean that like, it's just a different subgenre. It's, and that's where you kind of start getting into what we talk about, like underground, like the kind of stuff people trade around. Well, I guess no one trades anything around anymore, because it's the internet, it's just on the internet. Mm-hmm. But,
you still have to know about it, and you still have to discover it. Yeah. Someone's got to tell you about that thing you need to get.
Yeah, and the discovery part of it, like, whenever I hear people complain about anything with the film industry, like, there's not enough of this, I always go, like, you have to look around. Because, you know, it's like, when people are like, there's not enough female directors in Hollywood, I'm like, that might be true for Hollywood, but I see so many films by female directors. Mm-hmm. Female directors are making movies. Like, you just have to look around. Like, don't wait for someone to hand you, like, the menu. You know what I mean? Like, look around. There's other restaurants. Like, you're going to find the stuff. Like, start following. It's like bands, right? Mm-hmm. There's a band you like. let's say like there's a band and you read an interview with them and they mention a band that influenced them. So then you go check out those and then you hear about what influenced them. Then you go check out that and then you check out that and you kind of ride that thing. And basically just based on what you're reading, you find out all this other stuff about other bands. That's kind of how I feel about films. It's like, if there's a film you like, chances are it's emulating something in some way. You know, there's another film similar to it. So you just follow it. Or that director made another film. Or that writer made another film. And you just kind of, or that actor. You like, there's ways you just can kind of follow it. And as you hop around and read around, you can find, like, it's just, there's so much out there. It's ridiculous. I watch, you know, at my busiest, I'm watching like 3 or 4 movies a day. At my slowest, I'm watching like 1 a day. And writing reviews. And it's like, I can't keep up. Like, if you asked me what I thought of, like, Gone Girl, I haven't seen it because it's in a theater and it's mainstream and I don't get near it. It doesn't mean I don't want to. It means I don't get near it. Like, I just watched a documentary, I Am Santa Claus, which is actually on Netflix. And it's quite good. But it's the sort of thing, like, that to me, because it's on Netflix, it's like, well, that's kind of mainstream.
Yeah.
But I know it's not because I know the filmmakers in the other movies they've made and I kind of know their travels. So it's they've you know had varying success with their stuff prior too. So it's one of those things where, I'm that guy that you talk to who says that he watches movies all the time, and then you ask him about a bunch of movies and he has no opinion because he didn't see them. So, but that's the truth of the world as far as filmmaking is concerned, is that there's so much out there, you can't see it all.
Well,
and
I think
so
that
again, it becomes niche aimed.
Well, and I think that goes back to, you know, I quite often talk about search versus discovery, and you kind of hint on it there, where search, you need to know what you're looking for to start with, and discovery, you know, you don't know what you're looking for, but you know when you find it type of thing. Right. And you've got a group of people in the world that just want to be spoon-fed their entertainment, and there's mainstream, factory-based forms of entertainment to suit that, whether or not that's, you know, a movie theater or a concert series or whatever, it's there. And God bless those people, you know, they're out there, and I think, you know, a good chunk of the money that makes Hollywood and LA and all that swing comes, you know, from that mainstream, and they've figured it out. They've got the model down. I think one of the things that I've been seeing more and more in the last few years is a growth in people that are skipping outside of the mainstream and trying to find something different, and they're realizing that if we were to stop making content right now, whether or not that's movies, audio, anything, there's plenty out there to pick from. If all you did was pick a decade, you would have enough movies to last you a lifetime and probably come across stuff you would never watch in the first place. So are we seeing an increase in not only people creating content in those niches because of the cost, and also seeing an increase in overall across all those niches that are kind of more into, I want more, I don't want to be spoon-fed the mainstream?
Absolutely. There's definitely increase in every single regard, and it's just a matter of whether you're aware of it or not, but it's there. Like, I forget what the number is, like, even look at Sundance. Sundance, I think, got something like 12,000 submissions this year, or something absurd like that for 180 slots. You know what I mean?
How many of those slots are truly open? Because how many, you know, backroom deals have existed for the last, you know, how long has Sundance been around? 30 years now?
Yeah, Sundance, I think Sundance started in the 80s. So
my point being is there's always the networking that kind of goes beside it, right? So whether or not
people like to look at Sundance and be like, there's really no slots available, but there are slots available. Particularly, I feel like the stuff that you see in the Frontier section, which is kind of more what you think of when you think of independent and kind of really taking risks, and the stuff that kind of hits the competition section, those to me tend to be the more purely open slots. The stuff that you hear about as far as what they call premieres. The premieres are normally like the big name ones. Like, those are like this director's like new film that, you know, is an alumni, or and those are the films that they're submitted, but it's a different kind of system because
those are like a sponsored profile content to a certain degree.
In a way, yeah. So
whether or not
there's
direct
not,
payment versus, you know,
right.
In kind, you know, it's no different.
I don't think there's 185 slots open to filmmakers, but I think that a lot of times people, when they look at Sundance, again, Sundance is not the end-all be-all. Mm. And even the same thing, like people will go like, well, you know, Slamdance is a little more open in the sense that most of their slots are taken from new people. I think only special screenings are the ones that aren't, and those are like one or two films, and they're out of competition. Mm-hmm. But the thing with Slamdance is they have way fewer screenings, so the odds of getting into Sundance, I don't, maybe it's changed now just based on the amount of movies, but it used to be the odds of getting into Slamdance were harder than Sundance
just because of the viewing,
and people didn't quite get that. They always thought Slamdance would be my backup. You know, and it's like, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's just because Slamdance was getting all those people submitting to Sundance, we're submitting to Slamdance too.
So when you take a look at your upcoming schedule, because you're getting into busy time, you're getting into the Sundance, the South by Southwest.
Sundance, Slamdance, South by Southwest. Yeah, April is one of those months, which I've never quite understood, where like every week has like two festivals going, and like not really, really small, like, oh, 2-day festivals, but we're talking big ones like Dallas and stuff like that. It's the first 4 months of the year are pretty slammed with festivals.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a bit about the festival world, because, you know, you've seen them grow, you've seen them evolve, you've seen new ones come into existence as, you know, another one has become too big to, you know, kind of fill in that gap.
Right.
We know how important they are based on targeting people that want to see movies, whether or not they want to see your movie versus someone else. Then it becomes a competition of marketing at the event and
right.
pre-event stuff. But, you know, you've got your target audience. For people that have never gone to Slamdance, Sundance, South by Southwest, and keep in mind, South by Southwest, so there's also the interactive versus the movie. So
and
even
music.
Even itself, yeah. South by Southwest is much larger than the South by Southwest that you're looking at, right?
Well, I mean, because, you know, Film Threat's a website, Interactive has been a big part of my South by Southwest experience. So for me, when Interactive got going, you know, that was a big part of it. And I kind of watched Interactive grow from, it used to be music, and music was number one at South by Southwest, then film. And then Interactive came along, and Interactive was number three for a little while, but then Interactive kind of jumped, and I would almost argue Interactive jumped over music.
Mm.
Now I think Interactive music are probably a little more head-to-head because there was that kind of tech industry boom, and I feel like it's settling a little bit.
Well, yeah, and going back to that 2008 is not 2014.
Right.
You know, the Foursquares, Twitters, and all of those type of...
Absolutely.
You know, buzz yeah. for those years was paramount. And even last year, a lot of people were saying they really weren't seeing interesting products at all.
Well, no, you weren't seeing like, oh, here comes the Facebook keynote.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It already got spread too thin at that point. The Facebook that would have been there in 2008 may have been, but, you know, it wasn't discovered en masse.
Right. And it has expanded so much too. I mean, every single hotel in Austin, Texas has their conference room booked out for panels
mm-hmm.
through Interactive. And Interactive starts the same time music starts film, and ends shorter, and then music comes in. So film is actually overlapped by Interactive and music. So film is never by itself.
Mm. So, okay, so back to the original question, because
sure.
you've actually added to it, which is good, because you've got a complete view of South by Southwest. So walk me through your top three, your Slamdance, your Sundance, your South by Southwest. What does that look to you like? What do you look for? What are you expecting to see?
Well, for Sundance, you're trying to see as much as you can. I try... In all festivals, my main mandate is try to see the stuff that doesn't have distribution, because certain things are going to become obvious. Like a movie like Whiplash, for example, is getting a lot of buzz right now, but it was the sort of it was getting a lot of buzz back then. You know, it's the sort of movie that you know is going to get picked up, you know is going to be in theater over the course of the year, and you know you're going to get to see it outside of the festival world. So when you're at a festival, try to see the stuff you might not get to see ever again. You know, in a best case scenario, everything you see will you'll get to see again, but the realities of it are, you know, see the stuff that, you know, a lot of festivals will play movies that you know are going to open in 2 or 3 weeks. You know, like try not to key in on that stuff. Like try to make your festival experience and a uniquely festival experience. You know, make it something that you're not going to see. Like seeing what made seeing, for example, the Red State premiere a uniquely festival experience was that because it was that screening where Kevin was going to announce a distributor and that hadn't been done before. You know what I mean? So like there, again, it was him creating an event around it. And at the same time, there was all the protests going on outside. So like that was the event thing too. And it's like you want a festival, you want an experience of a festival. You want to kind of do that thing. You can't get in a multiplex or you can't get at home. You want to be challenged by the content you're watching. So that's kind of what I look for when I go. I'll admit that I skew a little bit more towards documentaries, but mostly because when you're reading a program guide, documentaries are the easiest ones to get a read on, in the sense that if a documentary says the world of bees, you know, when you go sit down for the documentary, you're going to see something about a bee, you know. You could see
it's not going to be the bee wakes up, takes the red pill and becomes, you know,
right.
Neo.
Which, so when you're kind of planning coverage, like you kind of go like, well, I know that I'm interested in bees. So I know I want to check this out. Whereas a lot of times narrative stuff, you'll get like the world of bees and it'll be like a coming of age drama and like a coming of age drama can mean anything. And it kind of depends on like, If that coming of age drama is at 8 a.m., maybe you're not ready for a coming of age drama at 8 a.m. because you might have something like the movie Wetlands, where it's all about a woman who, you know, is really, really obsessed with the moistness of her crotch and her asshole. And, you don't necessarily want to see that around lunchtime. So it's like it's a risk and reward type thing. Like you kind of play it out, but I also feel like those are the experiences that are really, really cool about a festival.
Well, look, you know, you just telling me this, those stories, you know, even in short form, I've got a grin on my face like you wouldn't believe. So yes, you're bringing back stories, not as much about the movies you saw, but of the overall experience. And I think to your point, if all you wanted to do was binge through, you know, 10 movies, well, you can do that using video on demand, and you might have, you know, that type of pure online Sundance type thing, but you'll never have that group experience or those off stories or the I can't believe I woke up here the next day type of story.
Right, and festivals know this. I mean, festivals know that the most successful festivals are the ones that have filmmakers there for their screenings, or, you know, actors there for their screenings. And it's not just the, ooh, being in the same room with a filmmaker and actor for the audience. It's about, you know, elevating that screening beyond just a movie. You know, it's about having, like, the Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas. Like, they do a ton of just kind of crazy stuff in addition to their festival. They have the Fantastic Fest debates where people debate a topic of contention, and then afterwards, after the debate is over, they then get in a boxing ring and finish the debate.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's elevating. Like, the best festivals are the ones that make it an experience. You know, even the smaller ones do it. Like the Oxford Film Festival and the Indie Memphis Film Festival, they're both within a certain range of each other, and they both for years had trips to Graceland 2, which was this guy's house in the middle of I think it was Mississippi, and he was an Elvis fanatic, and his house was just
had a very significant death, if I'm not mistaken.
He did, and it was crazy. I was a lifetime member of Graceland too.
Well, that's why I know about this before when you mentioned it. I'm like, I know this. Please.
But the thing was, like, his house was like, it was just this museum to Elvis, but like not a museum to Elvis in the sense of here's something really nice. It's like, here's every TV guide Elvis's name was mentioned in. And it's not necessarily true, but like this guy, he would give tours 24 hours a day of his house, and he would just, you know, some stuff I believe him and some stuff I think he was full of, you know, crap with, but it was just an incredible experience.
It's almost like the Ripley's Believe It or Not of Elvis.
Right. And the thing is, had I not gone to those film festivals and that had not been part of their, you know, kind of programming of, oh, we're doing a 2 a.m. trip to this fest or this, you know, Graceland 2. Like, I never would have gotten a part of it, but those festivals know that maybe it's not Graceland 2, but it's about integrating, you know, the area. Like, the smaller festivals really, I feel like the really good smaller festivals get that, and they really put you in the vibe. Like, going to the Waterfront Film Festival in Michigan, you know, they really, you're in this small waterfront town that's really, just really quite awesome. And you kind of, it's really self-contained. Even Park City for Sundance and Slamdance, it's, Park City is self-contained. Like, you're there, you can't help but experience that world. I think the bigger festivals, like the Sundance and say like the Toronto Festival, I think that it can be a lot of fun. I also think there's a level of frustration that can come with it as an audience member, because of, it's so challenging to see movies with tickets. Like, a lot of times you have to like kind of do the pass situation. And I've often, you know, remarked, like, I wasn't doing this as press. I don't know how many of the big festivals I would go to because of how daunting it can be. But having said that, a lot of the smaller festivals are just as incredible an experience. So I wouldn't, if I was someone who was looking into getting into festivals, I wouldn't necessarily say Sundance or bust. Just like to filmmakers, I wouldn't say Sundance or bust. I would say, look at the really small kind of regional stuff probably around you and just go get yourself a taste.
Yep. Well, both as someone that to experience a festival in the first place, but also someone to go through the festival cycle, you know, the business cycle of it all, right?
Right.
So, you know, I want to maybe wrap up on your overall impressions on being in this industry for as long as you've been in, seeing the technology shift through the years, seeing the attention level of people shift over the years. Where were we, you know, 20 years ago? Where are we now? Where are we going to be 20 years from now, type of thing?
Well, I think you can kind of start that with, there was the festival director of Sundance years ago, and he's not the festival director anymore, Jeffrey Gilmore. He said something along the lines when people were asking about submissions to the festival. And they said, because there was a lot more submissions, and they're like, well, how has that changed, you know, the number of submissions? You know, how's that changed the programming process? And he was honest in saying that the number of really good to great films that come in has not changed, but the amount of films that come in has. So, like, the level of quality still exists, but the amount of people trying is what is really different. And I kind of feel like that's kind of the entire thing with filmmaking. Like, I feel like just because there's more filmmaking out there, I don't necessarily know that the quality has increased so much as, you know, there's just more to work through. It does come from different directions. I think, like anything in the universe, you know, things tend towards equilibrium, right? So if we're in a boom in one direction, things are going to eventually start shifting in another. So if we have a ton of filmmakers, everybody becoming filmmaking, to a certain sense, we're eventually going to hit that point where fewer people are going to want to do filmmaking, probably based on the fact that the demand is not matching the supply. So what will happen is the supply will start dwindling again and the demand will start shooting up, and we'll kind of have that kind of feel of almost preordained by God filmmakers, you know, like the select few. And then it'll spin again. And that's assuming, you know, we don't all, you know, die in a nuclear war in the next 20 years or something, or, you know, the ice caps don't bury us in water, or, I mean, or any other financial massive change that makes even what we consider affordable today not affordable.
Well, there'll be a documentary about any of those things, so we'll see the documentary.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'll probably be like sitting in Park City watching them, being like, oh crap.
You know, it's like Burning Man meets South by Southwest, right? It's going to be the post-apocalyptic movie marathon of documentaries about how we got to where we are when the polar caps melted and the nuclear bombs went off and we all lost our food, right?
Well, and the other thing is, too, it's really what's kind of interesting now about a lot of the independent do-it-yourself content coming up now is that we've now had enough time with YouTube out there and web, you know, video blogs and stuff like that, where a lot of people feel like they are the story. And so a lot of content that you get along is where people are like, I am what's important. Like, I am doing a documentary, so I am the most important part about the documentary. It's like, no, it should be about what you're doing the documentary on. It's just one of those things, like, I always wonder kind of what the content of the future is going to be, because, you know, a lot of what we do comes from what we grew up in. So what's the filmmaker of tomorrow who had their entire music collection in their pocket their entire life and had all the knowledge of the world at their fingertips, but also the minuses of the internet that had like all those polarizing debates, trolling experiences, you know, and all that other, you know, kind of crap that comes with the internet, you know, rough social media battles, you know what I mean? It's like, what is that filmmaker going to create in the future? Like, what's their perspective going to be? And that's something I can't, you know, speak to because it's not the future, but like, that's what I'm most
Goes back to your point, you know, we're all influenced by something. So you've just described the majority of their influences, how those influences actually influenced, you know, we don't know. And what creativity will come from that influence, we don't know. But, you know, to your point, the number one YouTube star right now is someone that makes his living commenting on other people's content.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that's a film threat, you know, wish list right there.
Well, I mean, it's the crazy thing about it too, that I think it was years ago that I kind of noticed something like this, and I said to a friend, but it's kind of like, it used to be about the content and the commentary was secondary, but then it became about the commentary and now it's becoming about the commentary on the commentary.
Yeah.
And the content is like a distant. And I feel like you kind of see that the mainstream stuff because, all right, let's use Star Wars as an example because they just did the teaser trailer, right? We know.
Well, before you say anything, yay or nay?
You know, I'm meh.
You're meh?
I'm going to see it, but.
You know what? I don't want to say meh, but close to it. Please continue.
Yeah, I'm going to see it, but I'm not like super enthusiastic about it.
Are you guarded? Is that the word, maybe?
I am guarded, yes.
Yeah, I'll agree with guarded.
Yeah.
Okay, please continue. So Star Wars commentary.
Okay, yeah, so Star Wars. What we have is we know they're casting.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a very, very contextless teaser.
Yes.
You know, we've seen basically images that are leaking, and you can't see me doing air quotes, but I am.
Yep.
Because leaks nowadays are not leaks.
Nope.
You know, it's but the sort of thing where, like, or let's say even the Marvel movie slate, which is something I've been thinking about lately. It's like,
that's massive.
Yeah, but the news isn't the movie. Like, the movie itself, what the movie is actually going to be, by the time we get to the movie, we will have exhausted conversation about the movie.
Yeah.
You know, because it's already exhausting.
You know, in the old days, you'd have fan art done about a movie. We're doing fan arts about the teaser.
Right.
We're doing memes about the teasers. We've created more content based on 1 minute of 30 seconds worth of actual footage. And we're still a year away.
Right. And in an idealistic kind of optimistic view, I can say it's great that fans are getting this excited. And I wish I could be as enthusiastic personally. But the little bit of practical, again, that guy that existed back at the video store, you know, and the cynicism of it is like, we're just all being primed. You know, we're being primed to buy more and consume more. And it's just, the thing is, everybody knows that the focus is, because the focus has become so much about us, the focus then becomes our opinions. So all you have to do is give us something to have an opinion about. Give us something to be outraged over. Give us something to love. Like, if you really follow movie news, you know, the, like, me saying meh or guarded is not a popular, like, you go awesome over the moon, or you go, this is horrible, the worst thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Like, the middle ground, which is probably more realistic, is not what anyone wants to hear.
No.
No one wants to have that conversation with someone. You have to love it. But the thing is, as we see, like, not everything, in fact, the majority of things in our lives are not the greatest or the worst.
No.
But everything you hear about is the greatest or the worst. So it's real kind of, it's interesting that stage we're in. And again, that kind of goes to that future. It's like, okay, so if we're in a world right now where the commentary on the commentary is more important, and the commentary on the commentary tends to be extremely hyperbolic towards great or awful. Like, exactly what does that end up being? Mm. You know, like,
well, it's a very watered down, opinionated piece of content, but who am I to say that that's not of value?
Well, right. That's the problem with having an open mind. Like, because like, you can sit here and you can think about all these things and you can be like, this is crazy. But then at the same time, you stop and be like, but that doesn't mean it's not valid.